Hey, welcome you guys. While we're waiting for the last few people to maybe straggle in, I thought I'd tell you some things about kids say the darndest things. One day, our family was sitting at the dinner table in our house, and we live in the country, and the kids are all high school age at the time. And so there's five of us sitting around the table, and there's a sixth chair, you know, but it's empty. Well, we were sitting there, and I prayed before the meal, and just as I said amen, it was silent, and the front door just swung open. And we looked at each other, and we looked at the door, and it just stayed open, and we thought, what? You know, we were all thinking, that's pretty weird. And one of the girls said, well, maybe the Lord's coming to join us for dinner. And my son said, what was he, born in a barn? Oh, I guess he was. Then when our daughter was about two and a half, I came home from work for a quick dinner and then going back to work, and we were sitting at the table, there was just three of us then, and my wife and I were trying to talk, and she was, you know, our daughter had just learned to talk, and she was just jabbering away. It was Saria, and sitting in her high chair there, and I said, Saria, cool it, because we were trying to converse, and she goes, she looked at me kind of funny, and she went, blew on her food. But kind of the best one is my grandson Nate, who's here this weekend. I don't think he's in here. I don't want to embarrass him, but he was a real stocky little kid when he was. I said, man, he's going to play football, but you know he's 14 now and he's only about this tall, and it didn't turn out that way. But it sure looked like it when he was a little guy. Well, he was about whatever two to three years old, and I saw him kind of dancing around like this. I said, Nate, do you have to go to the bathroom? And he goes, yeah, you know. And so I rushed him in the bathroom, and I pulled down his pants, and I sat him on the toilet, and I realized that little thing is pointing right at me. So to avoid getting squirted, I put my finger on and pushed it, you know, so it would go right in the toilet. And he looks at me, he says, don't get your finger wet. I wish I had, you know, and I'm sure you feel the same way about your kids or grandkids or whatever. You wish you'd write all that stuff down. So, you know, the stories that you tell, you remember. But there's so many that you forget so fast, and they say the craziest things. How many of you here are single parents? Any single parents? That is unbelievable, isn't it? None. Wow.
They're home taking care of the kids.
Yeah. How many of you have children under 6 years old? How many of you have teenagers? Few. And how many of you are grandparents? About a third. Well, if you've got children 1 to 3 years old, or you know, in that range, and a few older ones and stuff like that, that is one of the toughest times in life. It as I look back. Because you're just physically exhausted all the time. That is if you're helping your wife any. And if you're not, she's probably depressed and in bed most of the day. But those are hard years. But be encouraged as they learn to, as they get out of diapers and as they learn to take their own showers and pick out their own clothes, everything gets just a little bit easier physically. You know, a little bit less physically demanding. Of course, then when they become teenagers, you have those late night talks, and it's hard to get up in the morning. But well, what I'm going to share this morning is definitely not the only way to parent. May not even be the best way to parent. But the things I share with you, I hope that you will be able to say, here is one thing, or here's a couple things I could take home and do that will make me a better parent. And give my kids a better chance at succeeding in life. So look for those one or two things that you could change that would improve your situation at home. Before we get started, let's pray. Father, the whole thing of life and reproduction has been your idea, and you've given us lots of instructions in the Scripture. I pray that our hearts would be ready and eager to hear those instructions, not just from the workshop this morning, but from our own time spent alone with you, pouring over your word and letting your Holy Spirit speak and guide us. And so, God, we ask this morning that as I share my thoughts and as these men contribute, we pray for your wisdom and application of the word in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, one of the first, the first point I think is the second most important thing in being a good parent, and that is to enjoy your children. To smile and be cheerful and be a yes parent. You know, I heard a guy a few weeks ago on a videotape said, you know, greet your children with cheerfulness. You know, when you come home from work, greet them with cheerfulness. Even if you've had a hard day. He said, their dog will. Good point. You know, the kid comes in, the dog's tail's just going like this, and he just can't wait. And if we're just a sourpuss all the time, we can't expect our kids to want to buy into our values. So greet your kids with cheerfulness and a smile. Philippians 3:1 says, finally, brothers, be joyful in your union with the Lord. Not joyful in your work situation. Not joyful in the small house that you live in. Or not joyful in the fact that vacation's coming up, but be joyful in your union with the Lord. See, nobody can take that away from you. It doesn't matter how your boss treated you that day. It doesn't matter what your co-worker said to you. If our joy is in the Lord, it can't be taken away. And in thinking of things of, you know, winning your child's heart and being a happy and joyful parent, smiling at him and that sort of thing. I was talking with a guy earlier and I said, you know, if you come home from work and their bike is laying in the driveway and it's drizzling and you can't get in the garage, and you know, there's probably 100 ways to handle that, but the two ways I think of is, one, you can go in the house, just, you know, the anger just seething up through you and your face getting red, and you can go in your house and say, I told you to not leave your bike in the driveway. Get your hind end out there and get that bike out of the driveway right now. Oh, can't I just finish? No. You know, and you're screaming and yelling at them, get out there and get that bike out, and maybe you usher them to the door. And or you could come in and, you know, they're playing their video game or whatever they're doing. We didn't let our kids do that, but whatever they're doing. And you come in and you can kneel down to them, beside them, and put your arms on the shoulder and smile in their face and say, guess where your bike is? Oh, man, I left it in the driveway, didn't I, Dad? Yeah. And you say, would you go out and get it out? And don't leave it there anymore. We've talked about this before. Please don't leave your bike in the driveway. In fact, the next time you do it, you know, and you can have some consequence. You know, I'm going to put it beside the garage and you can't use it for a few days or whatever. But do you see how totally different way that is to treat your child? To be gentle and patient and not screaming and yelling at them. You want them to share your values, and they won't do that if you're a real sourpuss. And if you're anxious and worried, and we all have those stressors in our life, but if you're living that way and it's showing in your home and you're uptight and bitter, resentful, maybe resentful toward your parents or the boss who let you go or whatever, and that resentment is showing, don't expect to raise happy, well-adjusted kids. It's not going to happen. If you're angry all the time and just on the verge of exploding, it's going to be really hard to raise happy kids. So be as cheerful as you can with your kids. Philippians, that next verse there, Philippians 1:27 says, whatever happens, conduct yourself in a manner worthy of the gospel. Boy, if we could remember that, huh? Whatever happens. You know, if your son leaves his bike in the driveway, if you've had a rough day at work, whatever happens, and you say, well, how can I be cheerful when life is so hard? Well, I think the key is Romans 12:12, and it says this, let your hope keep you joyful. Be patient in your troubles. Pray at all times. So let your hope keep you joyful. And I think we as Christians think, well, that means that I'm hoping for a better job. I'm hoping that this loan goes through. I'm hoping that we can get reservations for our vacation. That's not the hope I don't think that it's talking about when it says, let your hope keep you joyful. Because it's not hope for this earth. It's hope for eternity. And that can't be taken away from us. So let your hope keep you joyful. Be patient in your troubles. Pray at all times. And that kind of joy can be had in spite of any circumstances that are going on in our lives. We can be joyful. And Proverbs 17:1, better is a dry morsel with quiet than a house full of feasting with strife. What's the DNA in your home? Is it peace or is it strife? Is it quietness and joy? Or is it just constant agitation and frustration and that sort of thing? My paraphrase of that, better is a dry morsel with quiet than a house full of feasting with strife. I was thinking about that and I thought, you know, if I was going to paraphrase that in today's language or whatever, to say, it's better to share a peanut butter sandwich with a wife and kids that I love and I enjoy being around the table with, than to have a T-bone steak with tension so cold in the air that you could cut it with a knife. You know, I mean, how do you even enjoy a good meal if you're at odds with your wife and you're angry at your kids? And Scripture says, you know, it's better to have just a dry morsel. And some, you know, some people, I was talking to one guy here this week, and he said, you know, man, I was working 20 hours a week. And he said, I think, you know, obviously that probably contributed to his divorce and all that sort of stuff. Well, why was he working 20 hours a week? Was it so they could live in a big house? And I don't know the situation. It may have been just to make ends meet. But, you know, you'd be better off in a 1,200 square foot house with joy and peace than a 2,800 square foot house and just, you know, tension and frustration and stress that's going to kill you and going to destroy your family. Proverbs 5:18-19, let your fountain be blessed. This is about your marriage. Let your fountain be blessed. Boy, how could we get those fans to stay off?
We're going to thermostat in the other room.
Oh. Proverbs 5:18-19 says, let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. A lovely hind, a graceful doe. Let her affection fill you at all times with delight and be infatuated always with her love. And do you show your kids that you love their mother? Do they see you come in? And this is a big thing with me, and maybe it's just a personal thing, but one of the first things I do when I come in the house is look for my wife and give her a hug. I think that's a great thing to do. In fact, if I'm home and she's coming home, we live in the country, and so I can usually hear the car coming up the gravel driveway. And so I'll leave my desk or whatever I'm doing, and I go to the front door, and then I check, I'll open the door, and I say, do you need help carrying anything in? If she's been grocery shopping or whatever, then I'll run out to the car and help her do it. But otherwise, I meet her at the door and I give her a hug. And it just does something for your relationship, for your family, for the peace in your home. But if you walk in and just start shouting orders right away, or arguing about her, with her about what she bought, it's hard to have peace and joy in the home. And loving your kid's mom is the thing that's going to give them security and stability. I remember when our son was just about 5 years old, and it must have been, we were living in Indiana at the time, and it must have been there was some talk about a neighbor or somebody who was getting a divorce. And the little five-year-old came up to my wife and said, "Mommy, are you and Daddy going to get divorced?" So he was worried about it then. And I mean, he had no reason to worry about it because my wife and I have an unusual marriage, and we don't even raise our voice or argue with one another. And it just, and we've tried to figure out, is it because we're two wonderful people? That's not it. I think a lot of it had to do with the homes we were brought up in. We felt really secure and safe in our homes of origin. And so there's not that, you know, paranoia about what's going to happen in my home. But think about that as you raise your own kids. You know, if they feel safe and secure with their mom and dad, with you, that'll go a long ways toward helping them have a good marriage. James 3:17 is a verse that just, I mean, all of us want to be wise parents, right? Well, this verse has plagued me for a couple of years. It says, "But the wisdom from above," well, now that's God's wisdom, "but the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle," get this, "open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, without uncertainty or insincerity." So God's wisdom is totally without any uncertainty. And wisdom from above would be, right? And it says he's still open to reason. In fact, Jeremiah said, "Righteous art thou, O God, when I make my complaint to thee, still I'm going to bring it before thee." So it's like he knew that even though God knew everything and God was righteous in all his ways, Jeremiah says, "I still want to get it off my chest." And sometimes our kids need to do that, be able to get something off their chest. And if you're an unreasonable parent and you say, "I told you to shut your mouth," so you don't want to communicate with your children? You don't want to communicate with them? You know, shut up, be quiet, I don't want to hear another word come out of your mouth. Now, there may be a time for that when they're 4 or 5 years old and you've asked them to be quiet because you're on the phone or some other reason. There may be a time to say, "That's it, quiet, no more." But you don't want to do that when they're teenagers. If you want to maintain communication with your kids. Well, I think this whole idea of wisdom that's open to reason is something that a lot of parents fail at. And let me just illustrate with a couple of points. When our daughter was, she was 19 or 20. She was already graduated and had a job, but she was still living at home. But she got in the habit of coming in really late, like 2 or 3 in the morning sometimes. And it was driving my wife and I crazy. And we were having trouble sleeping. And, you know, you wake up at 2:30 and you say, "Oh, she's not home yet. Do I go looking for her?" You know, I mean, so it was frustrating us pretty bad. And we thought it wasn't good precedent to set for the other kids that were younger than her. So we prayed about it, thought about it, and decided, we're going to set a curfew on her. And I said, "Honey, if we do that, she may just move out." You know, I said, we're taking that risk. But we thought, well, we've got to do something because this just isn't working. So we decided midnight. So I waited till she come home. And she's a lawyer type person. I mean, she can argue with you about anything. And she's pretty stubborn. And so I was dreading it. But I went in her room and we visited a little bit, and I said, "You know, honey, your staying out so late is really taking a toll on Mom and I, and we just don't think it's good. It's certainly not good for us. It's probably not good for you." So I said, "We've decided, and I mean, we hope that you'll stay, but the curfew is going to be midnight from now on, and if you can't live with that, you're just going to have to find somewhere else to live." And boy, that's hard to tell your kid. I mean, not that I was worried about how she'd respond, but I just thought, I hate to have her move because I want to keep her here and be able to influence her. She said, well, I don't think that's fair. I said, well, what do you think would be fair? And she said, I think it should be 11 o'clock on weeknights and 1 o'clock on the weekends. I gave her a big hug. I said, that's a deal. But I could have said, I told you, we have decided it's midnight. If you don't like that, there's the door. And she would have walked, I'm almost positive, just because of her stubbornness, not because that midnight was a big deal. But there's two ways to approach your kids, you know, and be a reasonable parent anytime you can. When we were living in Detroit, our son was about, he was either fifth or sixth grade, right in there, and somebody gave him a jackknife. I think it was for his birthday or Christmas or something. And, you know, without thinking, he took it to school. Well, I mean, it was back in the late 80s, but still a lot of Detroit schools had metal detectors you had to walk through. Well, his didn't, but I don't know, somewhere mid-afternoon, he got sent home from school. He was showing a couple of his buddies and a teacher saw it. And, you know, I could have met him at the door and said, give me that knife. You won't see this again till you're a senior, buddy. How stupid can you be? You know, just read him the Riot Act. Told him not only that, you're grounded for 2 weeks, no TV, no this, no that. I could have reacted like that, but by the grace of God, I didn't. I said, Ben, you weren't thinking very much when you took this to school, were you? I said, man, you know, half the schools have metal detectors. You couldn't even got in the front door. He said, Dad, I just didn't even think about it. I said, I know you didn't, son. I said, don't take it again. Did I need to spank him for that? I mean, kind of loud. He was 11, 12, 13 years old. No, I didn't need to do that. He knew it was a dumb idea, but he didn't think of it ahead of time. Well, there's a lot of things we don't think of ahead of time. So be a reasonable parent whenever you can. You know, if the wisdom of above, from above, is open to reason, surely we can be. In fact, do you like dealing with unreasonable people? You know, whether it's a patient, a customer, a fellow employee, you know, a clerk at the store, if they're unreasonable, you don't like dealing with those people at all. And our kids won't like dealing with us if we're unreasonable. Be a yes parent whenever you can. I read an article when our kids were small about being a yes parent, and it just really caught my attention. And things like this. Suppose that you've got the little kids, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, whatever, in the car with you, and you drive by your neighbor's and he's outside and you decide to stop and visit with them a little bit. So the kids jump out of the car and you jump out and you're visiting with your neighbor and you see the kids headed for a mud puddle. And you look down and you realize they got their new shoes on. You say, stop. Hey, hold on just a minute here. Or, you know, one thing you can tell them, get your little butts back in the car or whatever. But you could go up there and just kneel down beside them. And I think this is a key thing, to get down on their level and look them in the eye. And somehow, you know, if there's not too many of them, take them by the shoulder so that they, you know, you're touching them too. And then say, hey, tell you what, guys, you can play in the mud puddle, but here's what we're going to do if you decide to do it. We're going to take your shoes off, put them in the car first, and then the Walmart sacks that are in there, you're going to have to wear them over your feet on the way home because you'll be dripping wet and muddy. But if you want to play, you can go ahead and do that, but let's take our shoes off first. And you can even go into, you know, depends on how much time you have and how detailed you want to get. You can even get into the thing of, you know, taking care of the stuff that God's given us. You know, you've got new shoes, you want to take care of them and all that kind of stuff. But be a reasonable parent, be a yes parent whenever possible. Here's another deal. We're fortunate enough to have 5 of our grandkids living within about a block of us. And we live in the country. Well, so they spend a lot of time at our house. They'll run up the hill or take the four-wheeler up the hill and come to our house or whatever. So there's been several times when they'll say, you know, they're playing and and maybe they're eating dinner with us that night or whatever, and they'll say, can we have a little soda pop or something? They don't get much soda pop at home. At least the one family doesn't. And so I could say, no, dinner's in a half hour. You're not having pop right now, you know. But generally speaking, I'll do this. I'll say, I'll get their glasses because we got their little letters on their glasses so they know which is theirs. And I'll get their glass. I'll put them on the table, and I'll open a can of pop or the bottle or whatever, and I'll pour about that much in each cup. And they'll drink it down and say, thanks, Papa, and run off. Now, I don't think that spoiled their dinner. But I was saying yes. There's so many things that we have to say no to them, Juan. Say yes whenever you can. Now, I'm not going to pour them a full glass. But you can compromise a little bit, you know, and say yes whenever you can. Enjoy your children and win their hearts. Point two, besides enjoying your children, is to nurture them. I looked up that word nurture, and it says to protect, provide, or to bring up carefully. So if we're going to provide what they need, we have to know what our kids need. And their needs are different, you know, from minute to minute, really. But 1 Thessalonians 5:14 says, we exhort you, brethren, admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all. Make sure you write down that last one, be patient with them all. So, you know, if a child is idle, he needs to be admonished. But if he's faint-hearted or discouraged, he needs encouragement. He doesn't need to be admonished. So, you know, take the time to figure out what is, you know, when a child is acting up, usually it's because his emotional tank's empty. And so try to figure out what is it that he needs right now. He may need just a stern talking to, or he may even need a spanking, it depending on their age and why they're acting up and that sort of thing. But try to figure out what does he really need right now, or what does she really need right now, and then try to provide that. Don't just use one size fits all and one discipline fits all offenses. And the deal on filling their emotional tank, I think, just like I said, eye contact, physical contact, and focused attention. Now, maybe this is a scenario that's happened in your home, and I think it happened in ours a few times too. But my wife's got dinner just about ready. She says, tell the kids to wash up, it's time for dinner. Now, if you're reading the newspaper or watching the news or, you know, finishing up something from work on your laptop or whatever, and she says, honey, tell the kids to wash up and come for dinner. One way to handle that is to sit right where you're at and yell down the hallway, kids, get washed up, it's time for dinner. Well, she could have done that, right? But if you'll close the laptop or turn the TV off or whatever and walk down the hall and say you got a three and a five-year-old boy and they're playing in the room and they've got toys strewn all over the room and stuff, get down on your knee, again, get them by the shoulder and look in their eyes and say, hey, Mom's got dinner almost ready. Let's wash up and get ready for dinner. And you take them in the bathroom, and of course the little one you're going to have to kind of hold up to the sink. And you help them wash their hands, and they see you wash their hands. And then they just throw the towel down and say, hey, boys, where was the towel when you got it? Oh, it was hanging over this thing. We'll put it over the little rack. And so you have lots of opportunities to train the kids while you're doing stuff like that. And then you can say, and we did this at our house a lot, I'll say, now when we're done eating, you keep your eye on me, because when I go, we're all going to yell out, thanks for the supper, Mommy. Okay, you guys got it? And so then after dinner, you know, they'll be watching me, and, you know, I'll give them a little signal, and we'll all say, thank you for the dinner, Mommy. Well, how much different is that than just yelling down the hallway, kids, wash your hands, Mom's got dinner ready? It's way different for the kid. It's way different for you. Because you know when you yell down the hallway, unless you've really trained your kids well, they're not going to go wash their hands. Right? Now, we can train our kids to obey us like that. And I think we should. And I wish I would have known some of these things a little sooner. I think they could have done a better job. But point C there, help them experience success on page 2. I think our kids need to feel good about something. You know, and I mean, our inclination as dads, usually it's, well, let's make them successful at school, their studies, or sports, you know, whatever your bent is. But lots of kids are successful at that kind of stuff. So even if they you know, have a B+ average, there's a whole stack of kids that are doing better than them. And they really can't even feel good about themselves about that. Now, maybe if they're straight A's, or maybe if they're, you know, quarterback on the football team, you know, starting in 10th grade, maybe they can feel successful about that. But pick some things that are a little bit longer lasting than football. You know, maybe that they become a great piano player, or my son got into ham radios. Well, there wasn't too many 13-year-olds that had their ham radio license, so he could feel really good about that. Now, he felt really stupid when he took it apart on his bed, chenille bedspread or whatever it was, and went to touch it, and a spark jumped and fried his thing. Just a what do you call that, static? Yeah. Electricity. Well, he learned, man, $200 down the drain real fast. But, you know, it can be things like even if your kid becomes an expert at arrowheads, you know, this was from this kind of period, and this particular arrowhead was used for actually as a knife or a spear, and, you know, something that they can feel good about themselves with. And you might have to learn it with them. My son was really into four-wheel drive, and he got all the magazines and read all that stuff. And I remember at midnight one time laying under a Jeep in our garage trying to hold up the transmission while he bolted it back in. Well, he had that thing, I mean, totally apart, laying all over the garage floor. And Bonnie, my wife, said to me, she said, he's never going to get that back together. But he did. And he, you know, you talked to him about four-wheel drive, and he can be up there with the best of them talking about the different details of it. But they need to feel good about something. Maybe if it's a daughter, you could, you know, teach her how to change oil in her car, or how to sew a quilt. In fact, this week, my wife has a little quilting retreat. It's kind of like deer camp, only the smells and sounds are different. But both of my daughters and both of our granddaughters will have a quilt done by today, because they started on Monday. And they, you know, they do all the cutting and all the sewing and all the pressing and then all the quilting and the whole thing. Well, you know, how many 12- and 13-year-old girls have made their own quilt? Not many. So those girls will feel good about it, a feeling of accomplishment, and know how to do something. So find something. You know, maybe it's how to butcher their own deer, or clean their own fish, or whatever you're into, photography, something that the kid feels like, I'm really good at this. And you have to kind of figure out what's their bent and what would they enjoy. Don't try to make them do something. Like I love to hunt, and I've got one grandson that the first time I took him, he was eager to go, and the first time I took him, he shot 2 deer in the first 15 minutes. And I'm going like, boy, this is going to spoil him forever. He'll never know what real deer hunting is like, the hours you spend waiting. But, you know, I couldn't wait for the next year for him to, you know, shoot some more deer. Well, he wasn't even interested. He said, I don't know if I want to go, Papa. Well, I could have pushed him to do it. But if that's not what he's interested in, don't push him to do it. Figure out what they really like and help him with that. Where it says build them up and distinguish between gift and effort, under build them up, write these words kind of in a line down. Write handsome, intelligent, and then talented/coordinated. And if your kid is any one of those, handsome or pretty or intelligent or coordinated or talented in sports or whatever, help them to see that that's a gift from God. That's not something they work for. In fact, you could help them learn this verse. 1 Corinthians, is it 4:7, that says, who sees anything different in you? What have you that you did not receive. If then you received it, why do you boast as if it wasn't a gift? You know, our looks, our intelligence, our coordination, our body size, all those things are a gift from God. And help your kid learn that these are the things I thank and praise God for that He's given me. Now, what if they're not handsome or intelligent? Well, then you can praise them, the child himself, for his own effort. You know, maybe instead of intelligent, he's somebody who has a friendly smile and he's courteous and polite. Well, praise him for that and help him see that that's something they can control. They can't control how they look necessarily. And instead of intelligence, praise him for diligence. You know, boy, son, I remember, and this wasn't even a comment toward me, but I remember hearing I had a brother that was a year younger than me, and he was talented and coordinated. Man, the guy could have played, I think he could have played any one of the three professional sports, basketball, baseball, or football. He was that good, just naturally. Never practiced, slough off as much as he could, and still be the best player on the team. I worked my tail off just to make the team. And I heard my dad one time say to another guy, he said, you know, if Dale worked just half as hard as Danny, he'd be playing professional sports. And I could have took that as a slam, that I just wasn't as good a player. But I took it in a positive way. I said, man, Dad recognizes the fact that I work really hard just to get on the team. Then instead of talent and coordination, you know, what my dad was praising me for indirectly was hard work and wholeheartedness in the thing. So okay, train your children, protect and shelter your kids. And this is something that you and your wife have to decide about what you're going to shelter them from. And I realize that's a personal decision, but take these three verses of Scripture, Romans 16:19, where Paul said, I would have you wise as to what is good and guileless as to what is evil. So I looked up guileless. It says naive or innocent. Paul said, I want you to be wise as to what is good and totally innocent and naive about what's evil. We don't have to watch The Simpsons on TV to know what's evil. If we know what's good, when we see The Simpsons and the lack of respect for humanity and the coarse language, we know that's evil. We don't have to see it to know it. Deuteronomy 7:26 says, you shall not bring an abominable thing into your house and become accursed like it. You shall utterly detest and abhor it, for it is an accursed thing. Now you and your wife need to decide before the Lord, and maybe with some study in the Word, what's the abominable thing and the cursed thing that you shouldn't bring into your house. But figure that out. And then Proverbs 4:23, guard your heart with all diligence, for from it flows the springs of life. And I wish I would have known some of this sooner, because I think one of the things that we would have decided early on is that our kids wouldn't be spending the night at other people's houses. Because like a guy, I interviewed a guy for this workshop, and just because I've been observing him and his boys for a while, and I really respected him. And so I interviewed him, and he said, one of the things we don't do is allow our kids to spend the night somewhere else, ever. Ever. Not even with grandparents. He said, because God has given me the responsibility to raise and train these children. And so I don't want to put them under somebody else to do that. Now, he does have them in public school, but I think he does quite a bit of deprogramming, too, when they come home. So decide what movies, what cultural media, you know, are you going to let them use Facebook and, you know, I don't even know what all that stuff is out there, texting and all that kind of stuff. You going to let them do that or not? But think of it ahead of time, and you can't wait till they're 12 and get invited to an overnight birthday party to say, no, absolutely not, you're not going to spend the night there. Start when they're 5 or 6 and say, you know, maybe they've got a friend that's spending the night at somebody's house and says, you know, when you get invited to do that, son, we're going to say no, and here's the reason. And then you explain to him the reason. You know, 1 Peter 5:8 says, "The devil is the roaring lion, prowling about, seeking whom he may devour." And so you explain to him that the devil is out there to devour us and to destroy our lives through our culture, through our friends, through the media, in any way he can. And they need to know that they've got an enemy. And so help them see that and explain it to them ahead of time. Why you do the things you do or why you don't let them do the things they do. In fact, this fellow I interviewed, his sons are 13 and 16. And he said, "You know, instead of me trying to tell you what I thought I did right," he said, "I let the boys write out a few things for you." And he said, and there was a lot of things that overlapped. But he said, "Now you have to realize I told them this on separate days. And so they didn't corroborate on this information. But there was a lot of things that overlapped. But one of the things on the list of things that they put that they appreciated about the way they grew up was Mom and Dad sheltered us from a lot of things." And they appreciated that. I was totally surprised. I thought, teenagers, they're not going to like that they didn't get to do stuff. But they did. And I think without some fences, without some borders or boundaries, a kid grows up and thinking, you know, not consciously thinking, but subconsciously thinking, my parents must not love me because they let me do whatever I want. And the devil tells us, well, you don't love your kid because you don't let them do that stuff. They're not on the soccer team, or they're not spending the night at this birthday party, or they're not going to this place or that place. The devil tells you that's because you don't love them. And then he tells your son, your parents don't love you. That's why they let you do this stuff. Okay, train your children in two areas. One is behavior, the other is thinking. Well, and telling is not training. You don't like go to the dog pound or the pet store and bring home a little puppy and set him down in the house and say, "Roll over, sit. You know, fetch." I mean, you got to train them first. And it's the same with children. If we don't train our children, you know, if all you do is shout commands at them, I mean, you would get nowhere with a dog that's not trained by shouting commands at it. And if you shout commands, "Go clean your room," but you've never showed them what you mean by clean your room, or answer the phone, or mow the lawn. I'm really glad our kids are old enough now because we live in the country and have a big yard, but I've trained them, and usually I'll get them started. We've got one field that's probably 3/4 acre, and so I'll go right down the middle, and then I'll turn around and I'll come right back. Well, what that does is it lays all the tall grass to the outside all the time, so I've trained them to do that. Now I don't have to. Because they know when they jump on the mower, they start in the middle of the field and they just keep moving the grass to the side. So instead of having all these clumps all over the field, there's just one rin row on the side of both sides of the field. But if I didn't train them to do that, you know, how would they know? We trained our kids to answer the phone when they were just little tykes. Because, you know, a kid hears phone rings and they run over and grab it usually. And if they just say hello and whoever's calling's, you know, not expecting a little 3-year-old voice, a lot of times they'll just hang up and I'll say, "Who was that?" "I don't know, they didn't say." So we trained our kids, and so we just did some role playing. We took a phone, we said, "Okay, ding-a-ling-a-ling, this is how we want you to answer it. When you pick up the phone, you say, 'Hello, this is Clark's, Benjamin speaking.'" And then the person on the other line says, "Oh, I do have the right home. Is your dad there?" So we trained them to do that. And we made it fun and we did role playing for maybe 15 minutes. You know, I mean, they were 5, 7, and 8. And took just a little time to train them to answer the phone. Well, it's funny because now they're 33, 35, and 37. Or in that neighborhood. And when they're at our house for dinner or something, every once in a while, one of them will pick up the phone and say, "Hello, Clarks, this is Saria." And so they still do it when they're at our house. But we've got to train our kids if we expect them to be able to follow through on stuff. And they, when it comes to behavior, they need to know that there's consequences. That Isaiah verse 1:19 and 20 says, "If you are," God says, "if you are willing and obedient, you will eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you'll be devoured by the sword." Now, we don't need any swords in our house, but we might need a switch or a stick or something. And so kids should know that if you're willing and obedient, hey, good things are going to happen here. We're going to have a peaceful home. You know, there's not going to be any yelling or screaming. And but if you're stubborn and disobedient, there's going to be consequences. And same with Jeremiah 4:18. All my grandkids know this verse. "Your own conduct and actions have brought this upon you. This is your punishment. How bitter it is, how it pierces to the heart." So they'll often quote that verse or part of it just as they're talking and say, well, their own conduct and action brought it upon them. And so there's consequences to our actions and our conduct. And you know, and you can start training a child from very young. That Proverbs 29 verse says, "The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother." And you can start training a child really young. Suppose you're wearing glasses, and the kid's only 6 months old, and you're holding them. And you train him just like you would a dog, basically. I mean, our minds work kind of the same way. And so if they reach for your glasses, you say no. If they reach for them again, you know, you can flick their hand or just pinch their little bare leg and pinch it pretty hard, and they'll go like, "What was that?" You know, even if they don't know it's you inflicting the pain. You know, a young child might not even know that. But to say, they associate every time they reach for glasses, they feel pain and say, "That's not a good thing to do." And use the word no so that they know that when you say no, there's probably going to be some pain coming from somewhere if they don't obey. Does that make sense? Make all bad behavior painful and unpleasant. Make all bad behavior counterproductive. Like, and it's so hard to be consistent. And that's we've asked our kids a couple of times, what is your biggest complaint about growing up in our home? And the two times I can think of that, we actually had kind of a family discussion and sat down and talked about it, said, you weren't always consistent. And one thing I can think of is my son begged to get a dog when we moved to the country. And I said, well, we'll get a dog. Neither my wife or I like pets, so we reluctantly did it. But we said, we'll get one if you sweep the porch every day, because the dog would lay right on the front step and get hair all over everything. If you sweep the porch every day. And I'll buy the first bag of dog food. After that, you have to buy it. Well, I didn't follow through on that. And I wasn't consistent. If I would have, I think it would have done a number of things. I think it would have taught him more responsibility, for sure. And they would have saw us being consistent, and they would obey faster in other areas, too. Maybe you've seen this, or maybe you've done it. Say you're sitting in the living room and there's a couple of toddlers. One of them's yours, one of them's the neighbor's or whatever, and they're playing around there as you're visiting, and you know, one of them takes the other one's toy, and it's your son who did it. He's 3 years old or 2 years old, still in diapers, and you say, no, leave that alone. That's their toy. Don't take it. And you know, and before long, they're overtaking it again. You know the scenario, right? Okay, so if he comes running by you, you're sitting on the couch, and I've seen parents do this, and maybe you have, grab him by the arm and, you know, actually literally almost lift them off the floor and then swat their butt through their diaper. Well, they have felt no pain from that, unless you misadjusted their back, which is easy to do with a little kid like that, you know what I mean? They felt no pain. They knew that you did it out of anger and frustration. And it's embarrassing to both of you. But if when they would have done that the first time, you had knelt down beside them and I said, "Now, I'm telling you, do not touch that toy." And if they touch it, then you say, "Excuse me a minute," and you take them in the other room and you make sure it stings. You know, and the Bible recommends a rod of some sort, you know, rather than using your hand, because otherwise when you reach for their shoulder to speak to them, you're going like this. But we need to train them and not be reactive in our parenting. Here's just some ideas of what areas to train kids in, and you and your wife need to decide what's really important to us. One of the things for us was we saw no reason for a 3 or 4 year old to ever open a refrigerator. I mean, in my mind, that there just wasn't any reason for a child to do that. And so our kids did not open the refrigerator till they were teenagers. I mean, we didn't have a hard and fast rule. It might have been 11 and a half or 13. I don't know what age it was, but eventually we started letting them open the fridge themselves. But other than that, when they were, you know, in grade school for sure, they never opened the refrigerator. It was just off limits. Because I said, if you're hungry, you tell me. Because you don't know the plans. We may be headed for the Dairy Queen in 5 minutes. Or Mom may have supper in the oven and you didn't even know it. But so that was one thing for us that we just trained. And they never did. They never even tried to when they were 7 or 8 years old. They would never even think of doing it because we trained them not to. Another thing for us, and you know, it depends on your capacity, but by Saturday or Sunday, we were whipped, my wife and I, when the kids were little. And so Sunday afternoon was our routine. After dinner, everybody's taking a nap. You know, and that worked when they were this big, but when they're this big, you know, they didn't want to take naps. And I wanted to be a reasonable parent. So I said, you know, I could have said, "Look, this is nap time. No matter what, you lay there and stare at the ceiling and count those little popcorn things or whatever. But do not get out of bed." Well, we didn't do it quite like that, but we said, "Look, we've eaten. Do you need anything to drink? Make sure you go potty. Now go in your bedroom and get in bed. You can take anything you want with you. Well, I'm not tired. Well, that's fine. Take a book. Take a color book. Whatever you want to take in your bed with you, that's fine. But you stay in your bed till we come down the hall and get you." And my wife and I would go take a nap. Now, there was maybe once, twice, maximum 3 times that they ever got out of their bed. And they got a spanking when they did, you know, on the back of the leg with a stick, and it hurt. And so they just didn't get out of bed anymore till we came down the hallway to get them. I mean, you can train kids to do that. You don't have to scream and yell and fight with them every time. You can train them if you will train them.
That's a question.
Yeah.
There's a couple of our small group, and they're adamant about not spanking, and their children are a disaster. And everyone else in the group believes in spanking. Do you have any? How would you react? What counsel would you give them to challenge?
Well, there's a number of factors. One is if they're teachable. If they're not teachable, there's really nothing you can do. A second is, are they open to looking into the scripture for it? And a third one, third I thought here would be, you know, it doesn't sound like they're controlling them without spanking. If they could do it without spanking, that's fantastic. But I remember being at a workshop here a few years back, and the guy said, "Now look," and he read probably 8 or 10 verses on the rod, using a rod to spank your child with. Now he said, "You can spank him with your hand, or you can use timeouts, or you can use stand in the corner." And my son and daughter, well, they spank their kids occasionally, but most of the time they're disciplined, and their boys are 1.5 and 4. Most of the time their discipline is go put your nose on the wall, and the child will go over there and put their nose on the wall, and they have to stand there till the parents tell them they can go. But what this fellow said who was doing the workshop, he said, "Now you can use any of those methods, but the only one God has promised will work is the rod. I mean, the other ones might work. And he said, you know, it's up to you. You figure it out. They might work, but the only one God has promised connected with it is the rod. And, you know, I don't know if you can, it depends on what your relationship is, how close you are to them as friends and stuff too. Make sense? Any other thoughts on that?
I actually taught a class on that a couple days ago, but because, you know, in modern society, it's almost frowned upon, you know, like a child abuse now, so you really have to be careful with that. And in our life group back home, our small group, there's a lot of couples that don't, and my wife included, because she came from that, but it was used wrong, so she has bad thoughts about that. But and she brought up a good example about, you guys might have heard the five love languages, you know, learning your spouse's love. And you really just have to kind of find your child's love language and what their currency is. You know, what hurts their feelings? Is it putting them in the corner? Is it spanking? Is it grounding them? Is it taking something that they love away from them? That might be something to consider.
Yeah. You know, and just logical consequences. You don't. I mean, spanking isn't the answer to everything. Like if you've said to your kids, you know, wash your hands, it's time to get ready for dinner, and they go down the hallway toward the bathroom and they find their little truck in the hall and they start playing with the truck and then they drive it into their bedroom and then they forget what they're doing and you say, okay kids, time for dinner, or you go to get them and you bring them back, you say, you didn't wash your hands, did you? And they say, no, I started playing with my truck and I forgot. And say, well, then you can't eat dinner tonight. You know, they're not going to die from missing one meal, but you better believe they won't want to miss a second one. And that's not, and sometimes we think, well, that's cruel and unusual punishment to make a kid miss a meal. Well, I don't think so. I was listening to a guy, and he said, I've trained my grandkids that when I say something, they do it right away. They don't need a second command. And he said, I was giving him a ride in my old Jeep, and he said it's got two batteries in it. And he said we're bouncing along, and he said those batteries. Something happened to short out, and he said there were sparks flying. He said, get out now. And he said, I bailed out the door. He was afraid it was going to catch on fire and blow up. And he said, I bailed out the door, and then I remembered their door doesn't open from the inside very well. So he said, I run around the back of the Jeep, and he said, they're on the ground picking sand out of their hands. And he said, how'd you guys get out? They said, well, you said get out now, and the door wouldn't open, so we jumped out the window. Well, it's funny. But it could save their life. It's not cruel to train a child to obey when you speak to them. Now, here's something I think we need to really consider, especially if you're a person who decides to use a rod, is never, ever switch or spank or use the rod with the child in anger or revenge. Sometimes, and I mean, the feeling wells up in all of us. You're making my life miserable right now. I'm going to make your life miserable right now. But that's the wrong way to discipline, obviously. In fact, what that results in is it breeds fear and resentment into a child. Because really, all you're doing is being a bully. You're bigger than they are. You're meaner than they are right then. And you're going to make them suffer. And if that's your attitude, you're going to build resentment into your children, and you're going to have big trouble when they're teenagers, because they are going to resent you for being the bully that you were. Nobody likes a bully. But, yeah. Well, did you hear the question? Okay. What do you do when they've got you really angry? Well, I think what we did, I'll tell you what we did. I don't know what all the answers are, but we used a stick to spank our kids. And it was actually like a 1x2 buck. About the size of a ruler, only a little thicker. And so I had to go get it wherever it was if I was going to spank them. But they also knew that if I said no, or, you know, whatever the situation was, that if I started walking for the stick, they were getting a spanking regardless. I mean, they weren't going to talk me out of it because I had to go get the stick. And so they would remember It didn't have to be immediate, but I mean, it was always within a minute or so. But it gave me a little time to cool down, and really, I'd memorize a few verses on it and ask God to bring them to your mind. You know, like the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, then gentle. You can give a gentle spanking. And a natural consequence, if they're fighting back and it's hard to give a gentle one when they're fighting back, then they just get a second one. But don't get me wrong. Obviously, you don't do it in anger, and you're not doing it to bruise. You're doing it to sting.
Sometimes the waiting actually helps with the discipline. If you're mad, you tell them to go sit on their bed or on your bed. You take that time to compose yourself. They're thinking about what they've done, and sometimes that waiting is the hardest part for them, the dreading the spanking.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to make them wait a little bit. That might actually make the discipline more effective.
That's a good point. Okay, well, training them in their thinking, page 3 there. We have till 10:15, right? You know, the devil doesn't force us into certain behaviors. That's not the way he works. He challenges our thinking just like he did Eve's. Because he knows when we start thinking wrong, we'll start behaving wrong. And it's the same with our kids. And you have to help them realize they're in a spiritual battle for their mind. Ephesians 6:12, for we're contending not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the world rulers of this darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in high places. In 2 Corinthians 10:5, though we live in the world, we're not carrying on a worldly war. So the battle is a spiritual battle, and it's for our children's heads, for their minds, to get them to think wrong. And that 2 Corinthians 11:3 there, Paul said, I'm afraid as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts may be led astray. So the devil deceived Eve in her thoughts. And so we want to help our kids recognize that there's a spiritual battle going on for their minds. When my grandson was, he was about, I suppose, 9, maybe 10, he was playing a bunch of video games, and I'd kind of sneak in there to see what kind of video games he was playing. Well, I don't know much about them, and I really should have spent more time figuring it out, but they were the kind where you run down a hallway and you box somebody and their head flies off and that kind of stuff, you know. And I said, Nate, man, I hate to see you watching this stuff. He said, well, Papa, I've turned off the blood part of it. There's some way he could turn off the blood. I don't know. But anyway, he said, it doesn't affect me. I said, Nate, everything we watch affects us. No, it doesn't. It doesn't affect me. Well, a couple days later, I'm walking out of the bathroom, and he was getting in the shower. I noticed he didn't pull the shower curtain shut. I said, Nate, you got to pull the shower curtain shut. He said, no, I don't want to. And it wasn't in rebellion. He was just telling me, I don't want to shut the shower curtain. And I said, well, you have to. You splash water on the floor. I said, Nate, are you afraid of something? Because I thought, why is he not wanting to pull it shut? Because, well, it gets darker in there then. And I said, so I kind of smiled on him. I said, so Nate, you can't be afraid of something you've never seen or heard about. Like a 2-year-old to play with a snake. They don't know they shouldn't do that. But I said, those games are affecting you. Oh, no, they're not, Papa. No, they're not. Well, about 3 days later, we're having a little weenie roast in the front yard, and his mom pulled up. She had been working late, so we were watching the kids. And she pulls up, and we're just finishing our hot dogs, and she jumps out, and she has a little package, a little like M&M type stuff, and she threw it at Nate, and she said, Nate, here's that candy you told me to buy. So he's eating and said, boy, these are really good. And I said, haven't you never eaten them before, Nate? He said, no. He said, you want to try one, Papa? I said, no, thanks. I said, you never ate those before. I said, how did you know to tell your mom to get them? I saw it on So I got right up to his face. I said, Nate, so the things you watch and hear does affect your behavior, doesn't it? Because he had seen it advertised on TV, and that's how he knew to tell his mom to get him. So there's a battle going on for their minds. You can look up those next few verses there. But the world is structured in a way to capture our thinking. I mean, advertisers, you know, why do they spend $1 million or whatever it is now, $3 million for 30-second ad on, what's the football game we just had? Super Bowl. Because they know. I mean, those companies are smart enough. They're not spending that money if it's not causing somebody to buy the product. So the whole world is structured to capture our thinking. And so we need to train our kids to think critically. And you can use something even like the other day I was giving the kids, now you got to make it age appropriate, but these kids were all 12 or older. And I was giving three of them a ride to school. And I said, guys, did you see on TV that guy who just recently, his wife disappeared a couple, 3 months ago, and then he was a suspect, so he was just getting visitation of the kids, and when the social worker came, dropped the kids off, he slammed the door on her. It was supposed to be supervised, but he slammed the door and then burned the house down and killed them all. So I said to the kids, I said, what do you think brought him to do something like that? I'm trying to help them think, see? So what do you think would go through a person's mind to make them kill themselves and their own kids and their mother? And they said, well, he's just crazy. Mm-hmm. I said, well, yeah, you got to be crazy to do something like that, but what gets you from normal to crazy? And then finally they came up with the idea of anger. Well, he must have been a really angry man. I said, yeah. I said, but what was he angry about? What makes us angry? Well, they couldn't quite figure it out. So I said, when you get angry, they all three have sisters. I said, when you get angry at your sister, what do you get angry at her for? So they're trying to think, you know, and we're talking about this. I said, well, you get angry because she's done something that you didn't want her to do, that kind of infringed on your plan or your happiness or your life or something. And I said, so what goes through a man's mind to make him so angry that he would kill his family? And I said, he had expectations of some sort that weren't being met. You know, whether he thought his wife was going to have a dinner ready every night and she didn't, or she was going to be interested in sex, you know, every day and she wasn't, or, you know, whatever it was. Things weren't turning out just the way he had planned or he liked, and it started welling up anger inside him. And so help your kids think about, you can even use stuff on TV, the news or things that you see, and stop it and talk about it. Use it as an educational thing for the kids to help them realize that, wow, this leads to this, leads to this, leads to this. And Scripture, I think, is an excellent thing. That 1 Thessalonians 4, 3 through 5. Here's what the verse says, and there's some questions you could ask, especially when your kids are reaching the teenage years. This is the will of God, your sanctification, that you abstain from immorality, that each of you knows how to take a wife in holiness and honor, not in the passion of lust, like heathen that do not know God. So I'm looking forward to talking with my teenage grandkids about this, because I'm going to ask them, what is sanctification? It says, this is the will of God, your sanctification. So we'll talk about what's sanctification. And then, what's immoral anyway? It says, abstain from immorality. What are some things that are immoral? And I want to talk with them about that. And then ask them the question, why would God tell us to stay away from immoral things? Abstain from immorality. Why would he tell us that? Because he wants to spoil our fun? You know, and think about it and say, What would it look like to take a wife in holiness and honor? We were sitting at the dinner table here a year or so back, and I don't know, somehow the kids were talking. And like I said, my son is 33, my other daughter's 36, and the other one's 37, I think. And the whole families were there, kids and everybody, and we were talking. And somehow they started talking about kissing. And what was your first kiss and this and that? And have you kissed other people? And then somebody asked my son, would did you have other girlfriends besides Heidi? And he said, well, yeah, I used to hang out with, I can't think of the girl's name right now, but I used to hang out with her a lot, but it was always in groups. And so they said, so is Heidi the first girl you ever kissed? And he said, yeah. In fact, she's the only girl I've ever kissed. And then Heidi said, well, I dated other guys, but you know what? Ben's the first guy I ever kissed. I thought, wow, that is awesome. That is awesome. How did I get on that? taking a wife in holiness and honor. What would that look like? And help a kid think through, what does that look like? If I'm going to take a wife in holiness and honor, what is that going to look like for me? And if I take her in the passion of lust like a heathen that does not know God, what is that going to look like? And I want to help them think about this. If you're so attracted to this girl right now because she's beautiful and shapely and her skin's nice and smooth, what are you going to do when she's 60? And she may not look like that anymore. There's a pretty good chance she won't look like that anymore. So if you take a wife in lust, passion and lust, it's going to be hard to be happy after 50. Do you not want to be happy after 50? Well, I guess that's your choice. But to me, it makes a lot of sense what God has said here, to take a wife in holiness and honor. Okay, last of all, and I think this is the most important thing, is that we need to set the example for our kids and grandkids to follow. Let me illustrate that. Well, I think these verses illustrate that really well. 2 Corinthians 7:17:41 says, so these nations feared the Lord, but also served their graven images, their children likewise, and their children's children. As their fathers did, so do they even to this day. As their fathers did, so...
That's
2 Kings? Yeah, 17:41. I'm sorry. 2 Kings 17:41. Thank you. 2 Chronicles 26:4 and 16 are an interesting verse because verse 4 says, talking about Uzziah the king, it says, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that his father Amaziah had done. So it sounds like his dad set a good example. But then verse 16 says, but when he was strong as the king, when he was strong, he became proud to his destruction. And if you'll read that other reference, 2 Chronicles 25:19 talks about his dad when he got proud and challenged another country to war. Deuteronomy 32:7 says, remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he will show you, your elders and they will tell you. Lots of people will tell our kids what to do. But we as fathers need to show them what to do. If you want your kids to have a servant attitude, you need to serve your kids. And I tried to do this as much as I could because somewhere in my psyche, servanthood was important. So, and I think biblically it's important. I hope that's where I got it from. But, you know, I'd get up when the kids were little and maybe we were watching a movie together or we're sitting around the living room or whatever, and I get up to get myself a dish of ice cream, and they're laying there on the floor. And I come back with the ice cream, and they say, Dad, would you get me a dish? And I mean, my first thought is, get off your lazy butt and get your own ice cream, you know. But generally, especially if I gave it any thought at all, I'd say, sure, let me get you a dish of ice cream. And I'd go get it for them. But if I want them to become a servant, I want to model it for them, right? And to me, our goal as dads is to represent God as well as we can to our kids. So we want to show them grace. We want to show them judgment. We want to show them firmness. We want to show them love and mercy. All those things we want to impart to our kids. And so one day my daughter was getting ready to go to school, and I said to her, hey, I saw she didn't have her lunch in her bag, backpack or whatever. I said, hey, put your lunch in your backpack. I will, just a minute. I said, honey, you're going to end up forgetting it. No, I'll remember it. Well, she went to school and forgot it. And when I was working in my office and I came up the stairs and there sat her lunch on the counter and I thought, well, it's not going to hurt her to miss lunch today. But then I thought, well, maybe I could use this. So I put the lunch in the car with me and I drove to her school and I can't remember how I got her out of the school, but she came out and I gave her lunch. I said, now, honey, this is what grace is. I said, I warned you ahead of time that you were going to forget your lunch and I tried to tell you to put it in your backpack, but you didn't do it. And so you really didn't deserve for me to bring it here, but I'm doing it to show you what grace is. Grace is getting what we don't deserve. And I said, that's what God does with us. Have a good lunch. And it took off. Well, that whole idea of showing, I believe that Jesus, in John 17, 6, he says, I've manifested your name. And he's talking to his disciples. I've manifested your name to the men you gave me out of the world. Thine they were, and thou gavest them to me, and they have kept thy word. So he said, I've manifested who you are to the disciples you've given me. Well, I think our kids are our number one discipleship priority. So I want to manifest God to my kids and my grandkids. And not just by telling them. It says, Hebrews 1:3 there says, talking about Jesus, it says, he reflects the glory of God and bears the very stamp of his nature. And then Colossians 1:15 says, he is the image of the invisible God. So we can't see God. Our kids are, you know, probably aren't going to see God. But can we bear the stamp of his nature in a way that when they see us and how we relate to them, they will know who God is? I think that's what Jesus was saying in John 17. I've manifested your name to the men you gave me. And he did it by showing them. Like that Luke 9 passage there is where they come out of a village and the village rejected him or something. I don't remember all the details of it. But James and John said, Lord, should we call down fire on this village? And Jesus said, he reveals God's heart to him right there because he said, no, I didn't come to destroy life, but to save life. So see, they're beginning to see who God is. He's not this guy who just says, you disappointed me, you made me unhappy, here's some fire from heaven. Or when the Matthew 19 there, when the children are coming to Jesus and the disciples are shushing them away, you know, get out of here. And Jesus said, no, suffer the children to come unto me. So he was showing them what God is like. And that's what we need to do for our kids and grandkids. That 1 John 2:6 verse there, he who believes in him ought to walk in the same way in which he walked. And the question is, are you walking in his ways? That's not in your notes. 1 John 2:6. But it says, we're to walk in his ways. And I thought about this. When I discipline my child and I walk out of the bedroom, ask myself, in fact, it'd be better to ask before I go in there, but am I doing this his way? Because if I say I believe in him, I ought to walk in the way in which he walked. One second. Or how about when you return a purchase to a store? You're really unhappy with this thing you bought. Are you going to return it in his way? Because if we say we believe in him, we ought to walk in the way in which he walked. Go ahead now.
Well, one thing I thought I'd mention that may be helpful for some of you guys is one thing that I always do with my kids when I discipline them, when I take them back to the back room for the spanking, is to share the gospel with them. And not only am I sharing the gospel with them and reminding them about the fact that Christ paid the penalty for their sins, they're going to have this consequence, and this is part of discipline, but ultimately it's that sin that separates us from God. And that, you know, so I share the good news with them. At the same time, I'm sharing it with myself. And it's a reminder again as I'm preaching the gospel to my kids in that time. So I find that really useful. It also gives you a little bit of a pause and allows you just a moment to settle down a little bit and really imparted to your child, what's the most important thing? Not necessarily the outward behavior that's going to change from this, but the fact that Christ had died for their sins and that they're going to have freedom in Him.
All right. Let me just share a poem with you about our example, and we'll close with this. So if you can picture sitting in a chair and your toddler comes running up to you, 5, 6 years old, 4 years old, whatever. It says, "To get his goodnight kiss, he stood beside my chair one night and raised an eager face to me, a face with love alight. And as I gathered in my arms a son God gave to me, I thanked the lad for being good and hoped he'd always be. His little arms crept around my neck, and then I heard him say, 4 simple words I can't forget, 4 words that made me pray. They turned a mirror on my soul, and secrets no one knew. They startled me. I hear them yet. He said, I'll be like you." Well, all of us have screwed up in being parents. All of us have made huge mistakes at one time or another. Maybe you're sitting here today and you say, "I've done nothing but make mistakes so far with my kids." Don't get discouraged. Just get started. Just get started. Take one or two things and begin to practice it. And be resilient, because you're going to make mistakes again. But I looked up that word resilient, and it says to be crushed and then to return to its original shape. So if you think of a beach ball and you smush it down, and then it returns to its original shape. So when you mess up, don't say, "Well, I might as well throw in the towel." Just say, "Okay, I got to start over again. Do it right this time," and pray and ask God to help you. And it's not the rubber of the beach ball that makes it return to its original shape. It's what's inside it. All right? God bless you.